Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 916. This episode brought to you by Loot Crate. Be the envy of your friends and get your 100% exclusive crates at lootcrate.com/nerdist. Go ahead and enter the offer code Nerdist. Save 10% off any new subscription. November's Loot Crate theme is Unite 2.0. So that means they've joined forces with Justice League, Voltron, Overwatch, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers for a crate full of incredible items. And also, all subscribers are going to get a free download for the first season of Batman the Telltale Series as this month's DLC, a $25 game on Steam. And then one lucky subscriber will win a mega crate of epic proportions. You have until the 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive that month's crate. And when the cutoff happens, that's it. That's over. So you still got 10 days as the posting of this podcast to get in November's crate, which is Unite 2.0. I mean, surprise yourself. Surprise a loved one. When I say surprise yourself, I mean, you'll forget that you ordered it and then things will come and you'll be like, oh my gosh, it was very difficult to surprise yourself. But if you can do that, I say surprise yourself. If you want to get fancy, a bigger box with bigger loot is available called Loot Crate DX. These are monthly wearables, accessories with cult classics, favorite franchises. And if you're more of a fashion person, try Loot Wear. So there's a lot of loot stuff in the loot verse. So check it out, lootcrate.com/nerdist. Enter the offer code Nerdist to save 10% off any new subscription today. Let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard from Nerdist folks just like yourself. Derek Dwyer writes, I was hoping I could add my free comic book to the Community Corkboard. Done. It's because of Chris, Pete, and more over at Nerdist that I decided not to wait for somebody to ask me to write and draw a comic book, so I just decided to do it myself. Damn right. It's a free 24-page full-color comic book, story and art by me, at @Dwyer_Derek, D-E-R-E-K. It's an action sci-fi drama comic set around the crashing of an alien spaceship. You got monsters, swords, and Buddy the dog. It's called On My Shoulders. It can be found on Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, DeviantArt, and Facebook. Search On My Shoulders comic book, facebook.com/onmyshoulderscomicbook. Probably the best place to read it, though, is on Facebook, he's saying. So thanks so much for the years of free podcasts. You're welcome. And makes the days of being a greenkeeper in Ireland fly by. Oh my gosh, a greenkeeper in Ireland. I'm going to come visit you. Gotta come to Ireland. User Flamingo Fast on Reddit writes, my 10-year-old son is raising money for an educational field trip to the East Coast. He's doing so by selling Lego jewelry on Etsy. Amazing. Everything he sells, he has designed and created himself. He'll be adding to his inventory between homework and robotics responsibilities. Thank you so much. So if you just go to etsy.com/edudctripfundraiser, I'm on there now. These are adorable. These are adorable, like Lego necklaces and earrings. And come on, you gotta help this delightful kid have an educational trip. All right, well done. This episode is John Bernthal, and he is promoting The Punisher, which is on Netflix soon, and his upcoming film Sweet Virginia in theaters November 17th. I never really talked to John that much. Our paths just didn't cross because when he was leaving Walking Dead, I was just coming in, and so we only kind of knew each other peripherally. But
What a great fucking guy. Oh, my God. Very sweet, very thoughtful, really cool. I was really, really, really happy to have him on. And, you know, we talked about a lot of stuff. You're going to love Bernthal. You are going to fucking love Bernthal. So thanks to John for coming on the podcast. And also this podcast was brought to you by Stamps.com. Going to the post office sucks. Oh, my God, especially now. It's November. You know, there's already Christmas decorations up, which means Christmas stuff is in full effect, and it's not even Thanksgiving yet. But avoid the hassle of the post office. Mail everything from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic or international, with Stamps.com. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. You click print mail, and then you're done. And it never closes. All right, 24/7. So you can enjoy Stamps.com with a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus postage in a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. And now, Katie Levine, in episode 916 of the Nerdist podcast, presenting Mr. John Bernthal. Katie, roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I was so blown away when I ran into you at Comic-Con. You go, hey, I listen to the podcast. I was like, what? No idea. I mean, because you were going out as I was coming in.
Totally.
Basically.
Totally.
And still people go, I wonder how Shane would do with Rick. I mean, I'm sure people ask you all the time, but you couldn't have had any concept that Walking Dead was going to have this kind of indelible mark.
No, man. I mean, I think, you know, the wonderful world of Walking Dead, you know, I feel like, you know, when the show came about, its roots were so humble, you know. I mean, it was so humble, and I feel none of us had any idea. That being said, there was this like, you know, I don't want to be cheesy, but like this like burning desire to be a part of it. I mean, at that point in my life, I was going through all kinds of crazy stuff, and I was being sued. I had, you know, I was having sort of like financial difficulties, and it was the first time, you know, I think I had this offer to be on one of these sort of big procedural, you know, crime shows,
right,
that had a syndication deal, which would have been like, your money problems are over. And I remember I had this audition for Walking Dead. I just read the script, and I just, you know, to sort of the shock of my family and all the people around me, I just sort of said, you know, until I can throw my hat in the ring for this, I can't take anything. And at that point in my career, like, I would have taken freaking anything.
Holy,
you know what
shit.
I mean? And I just loved this script so much. And it was just one of those perfect jobs that, you know, as you got closer and closer to it, you know, once I met Frank Darabont and once Andy was cast, and even the audition process was so humane and like lovely, you know, oddly, which, you know, they never are. And it just is one of those jobs that got better and better and better, and then just had this added bonus of, you know, people liked it. But we had no idea, man. I remember Sarah Wayne Callies telling me, if a million viewers watch this show, we're going to be all right. We're going to get a second season. You know what I mean? And I was doing this movie at the time. I'd just been married, and I did this movie at the time with Woody Harrelson. And I remember lunch just ended, and Woody Harrelson came back, and I guess he had read the trades or, you know, read something online. He's like, 5 million people watch your show, dude. And I was like, what the fuck? You know, that's a lot more than a million.
That's insane. And that was insane on cable specifically at that time.
Yeah.
Like, now everything has blown up so much, but that was not common back then, even just seven years ago.
Yeah. I mean, it was, and like, you know, it wasn't a huge vote of confidence, you know, picking you up for six episodes. It's not like, hey, man, this is going to kill. And you got to remember, like, AMC at the time, that was, you know, it was like Mad Men and Breaking Bad. It was super prestige television. And we kind of felt like the assholes who were making the zombie show. But I remember, you know, Frank and all of us sort of got together. And our goal was to, to make something that the Mad Men and the Breaking Bad audience would dig, you know, and would be sort of, you know, transcend the genre a little bit. But I remember, you know, with you, I remember you coming on, and it was sort of like right. I remember you moderated a panel at, yep. at Comic-Con in San Diego, and you know, it was right sort of at the time right after that, you know, with Frank's exit and all that, and it was just sort of like, you know, that the show was just sort of growing and growing and growing, and I can't, you know, what it's become. It's just like, it's a phenomenon. I mean, I always say to people, you know, never underestimate the power of that show. It just sort of grows and grows.
Yeah, but it's such a, I mean, what an interesting thing in your gut, because the procedural is sort of the blessing and the curse of television, I think, because I think people go, oh my God, like you said, I'll never have to do anything again. This, I'm set for life. And then I think maybe like two or three seasons and people start to go, oh, so this is the thing I get. And certainly nothing against anyone who takes those jobs. But sure. I think, you know, if you want to be able to do a lot of things, I think that type of very, very long-term procedural path doesn't really allow you to do much.
That's
else.
It, man. And I knew for me that wasn't for me. And luckily, the people that, you know, represent me, I think that they knew that too. And that's a hard thing, you know. I mean, it's a hard thing, you know, for someone who's getting 10% of your shit, you know, to be like, hey, man, don't go that way. Do this one. That's, you know, like, you know, throw your hat in the ring for this one. But I'm super grateful that I did it. And I think that, you know, throughout that process, which was so insane, that audition process for Walking Dead. But I feel like, you know, and then having it sort of go the way that it did, I don't want to be cheesy, but I'm just so enormously grateful for that show. I'm so enormously grateful for my time on that show, for the friendships that I've made on that show. And I'm so grateful to have moved on from it and to have gotten this unbelievable opportunity to play a character with a real beginning, middle, and end, and these sort of buoys that were set in place along his journey, you know. But you know, that's a real thing, and to sort of know going in, hey, you're not going to last, and to know you're going to go from X to Z, and you know, it's an unbelievable opportunity as an actor, and I feel like you know, I just I owe Frank, and I owe that show and that cast, Andy Lincoln, I owe them so much. I'm always going to be indebted to them, and they'll always be among my greatest friends, sort of in the business. You know?
Well, not to Talking Dead you, but because you never were able to come on the show, it didn't really exist much when you were on the show, yeah. But it's just, and we'll just talk about this for a quick second, but sure, it's interesting to see where Rick has gone and where Shane said, you basically said, you can't survive in this world, I can survive in this world. Mm-hmm. And now Rick has gone through so many different psychotic iterations. Sure. I mean, do you think if Shane were still alive, do you think he would have done anything differently? Or do you think, you know, do you think he would be kind of proud of what Rick has done?
You know, look, man, I'm not going to bullshit you. I got three little babies, and I'm like, you know, they got lots of diapers to buy, so I work like crazy. So I haven't been able to completely keep up, you know. But that being said, I think that, you know, for me, what Shane always was I felt it in a palpable way while we were making the show. I felt he was the first guy to sort of figure out the rules or lack thereof of this new world. And right. I think it all started, you know, again, not to Talking Dead you, but like, I think it all started with you know, that that character Ed, you know, who's beating his wife Carol, played by Melissa McBride, the biggest gangster ever. You know, that day that, you know, he's sort of just been told by Lori to leave her alone, and then he saw him beating his wife, and he went over and he broke it up as he would have in the old world, but then he hit him, and then he hit him again, and then he hit him again. And I remember Frank writing, he needed to find something there in the beating of this guy, and just to beat him and realize in that beating, hey, there's no rules out here. I could actually just keep beating this guy as long as there's no police. There's right. Nobody who's going to come to get me. And then I think a couple episodes later, he sees Rick walking in the woods, and he's got that gun trained. They're right. Looking for something. And then he just all of a sudden says, you know what? Like, actually, in this world, I can do what I want. Like, right. I could just handle this now. And just these seeds are being planted. And I think, you know, then everything sort of got put into overdrive with Shane. And I think he really figured out what this new world was. And it was going to dawn on everyone. I think that's why he had all that sort of like beautiful frustration that he had with Rick and the choices that he was making, because he really saw the new world, and you could not apply old world rules to this new world. And so I think he was ahead of his time that way. So I think it's only logical that Rick would sort of come to this sort of same place.
And I had this really terrible joke when everything was going down with that, because then Shane hooks up with Andrea in the car, and then there was a question about, well, whose baby is Rick's baby, is it Shane's baby? And I said, all right, if it comes out of Lori and goes into Andrea, it's Shane's. Everyone's like, ah, come on. But the idea that they've that Rick essentially accepted, like, all right, you know, biologically this may not be my baby, but I accept it. I accept this world. So I feel like Shane really did, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, pass on some spiritual DNA to Rick. And I guess Rick, we have said many times, like, oh, Rick is embracing the Shane now. It took him longer to realize the more you cling on to the old worlds, the less able you will be to survive in this new world. But if you hadn't died on the show, then you wouldn't have gotten to be the Punisher. And you were so fucking good that season of Daredevil. Oh, and my wife and I are both like, I can't wait to see this guy in his own story. But, I mean, I cannot imagine anyone else in that role. Did they offer that to you, or did you audition for it? Were you aware of it? How did it come around?
We had talked. I was doing a movie in Ireland. I was playing a mute in the movie, and right, no lines
memorized.
You don't, man. That one they gotta just give you. You know what I mean? But I would hate to see the fucking audition. Marceau bullshit.
Stand over there. All right, now walk over here.
Done. Yeah.
We're gonna go another direction.
Off book.
I fucked that up.
You know what I mean? Like, ow, what the fuck? But I mean, I remember you know me being sort of the asshole I was. I figured that the only way I was the only American in the movie. It was Tom Holland and Stanley Weber and Richard Armitage, you know, and it was great, beautiful script and cool story. But I sort of went into it saying the only way I'm going to be able to do this sort of accurately or authentically I had to stop talking. And so I just stopped talking on set, off set. We were all living together in this little place in Western Ireland. So, we were all staying under the same roof, having all our meals together. So after work, you know, I'd be silent all day at work. And then we'd all be sitting around the same table. And here comes like the asshole American who thinks he's fucking Daniel Day-Lewis. You know what I mean? Who's like not talking. You know what I mean? I'm like writing notes like, hey, man, can you order me the salmon? You know what I mean? Like, and it was just, it was so exhausting for everyone. But I remember, you know, about a few weeks into it, I finally realized that part of the process was being detrimental. You know, it was helpful to me, but I feel like overall it was becoming detrimental. When you don't have any lines and you're a lead character in the movie, if you're not communicating with your director, you know, I have to develop my own language, right? So my language was through gestures and through looks and through reactions, but he's covering the line. So if he doesn't know what I'm doing because of my fucking acting exercise, I'm not telling him, you know, just shit was getting missed. You know what I mean? And anyhow, so I start to, and the whole cast down to a T agreed that they liked me better silent than when I was talking. But anyway, that during this whole time is sort of when the Punisher thing kind of came about, and I wasn't really communicating with back home, you know, both because there's no internet where we were, and it was just tough. So it was sort of weird. It was kind of through this like archaic kind of like. You know, like through the cable, we were sort of going back and forth. Hey, they're interested in you in Punisher. So we made. I knew that there was interest. I think they had seen Fury, and you know, my agent represents Charlie Cox, so I think that they sort of had some. There's a little bit of inside baseball there, knowing that it was going on, and you know, and we made a tape, man. I remember they wanted to see a tape, and the tape was the audition tape was a dude who was taking his I think was hunting with a young guy, and the young guy was afraid to shoot the deer, and he had to like talk him through it. You know, it was like fake audition scene. So Tom Holland and I went and, you know, I had been working with him on his Spider-Man audition tapes. And
Oh, that's so fucking great.
Right? So Tom and Holland, we'd been in Ireland, like the middle of nowhere forever. And then we went to Liege, Brussels to shoot the last bit. And Liege was like fucking, I mean, it was like the biggest metropolis in the world compared to where we were in Ireland. So we were like feeling ourselves, you know, like going out and eating French fries and shit. And, we were in this park and we shot this scene, and then this actor Stanley Weber played the deer. He was like going in the background, like munching on grass like an asshole. Yeah, it was so fucked up. So,
oh my God, that tape's got to be around somewhere.
Oh man, it's so fucked up, man. So, but like that was a tape. So Tom and I made this tape, and that was sort of it. And you know, I hadn't seen the show, but I'd seen you know once I knew there was the interest, and we started talking about it. I watched, and I remember Charlie's first monologue in the first episode of Daredevil. And the sort of, you know, the kind of work he was doing and the attention and the time they let him have to deliver that monologue. And then I saw, you know, D'Onofrio and I said, okay, shit, man, I want in on this. Like they're really letting people explore and go for it and be bold and they're turning their back on the audience. And it was exactly the kind of TV work I wanted to do.
I think it's really nice for fans to hear that you helped. There's so much Marvel simpatico going on. Like, you helped Spider-Man become Spider-Man, and Spider-Man helped the Punisher become the Punisher. That's really sweet, because Tom seems like a super sweet, super
Tom,
guy.
Tom's the greatest, man. And I saw him sort of go through that. I mean, his process was a lot longer than mine. And, you know, he was going in through audition after audition. And you know, we were making tapes in Ireland. I've really never seen, you know, I come from sports and I do think there's a lot of similarities between, you know, what we do in athletics. And I always try to take sort of an athletic approach to the work, you know, in anything, boxing, football, baseball, anything I've done before, surely, you know, acting. I've never seen someone with so much drive and so much discipline and so much belief as Tom Holland. And he wanted this to happen, and he made it fucking happen. And he did it with grace and with kindness and with work ethic. And, you know, for me, I'm just, you know, I remember, like, you know, before scenes, he'd just be sitting there and be like, I'm fucking Spider-Man. I'm like, well, actually, no, not now, dude. Not now. Now we're in like 12th century Ireland. But I'm like, if I said that, I would be so worried that I like fucking jinxed myself.
Of course.
You know what I mean? But he was just so, and I think it really comes down to the guy. He just comes from this wonderful family, super close with his brothers, with his parents. His parents are great. He's just got a great head on his shoulders, and he's equal parts talented as just a really good, genuine, kind person. And I think he's going to be able to do anything he wants in this world and remain like a solid person at the same time. And I love him. I really love him. And the guy blew me away.
I want to ask you about, because you said your background was sports, and you mentioned boxing, you mentioned all these different sports. I did not come from a sports background. My dad was a professional bowler, if that counts. But,
right, but are you good? Can you bowl?
I can bowl. I can bowl very well, but that's it. By the way, John has a pup here, and it's the fucking cutest.
Get down right now.
It is the cutest.
Stay.
The cutest pit pup. That dog is all kinds of adorable.
Yeah, he's a little asshole. He's learning.
But you said you come from a sports background. Was it all of those things?
I mean, not bowling. I can't bowl to save my life. I mean, yeah, you know, like I grew up, you know, I come from sort of a big basketball family. My little brother and my dad played college basketball. My little brother played college basketball at a real high level. He was an All-American quarterback in football. You know, I played football and baseball, played college sports, you know, boxed. I come from that world. All my best friends in the world are still the guys that I sort of grew up playing sports with. And one of my best friends, Sean Kerrigan, he's a pro fighter, a guy that I boxed with forever. I come from that world. I wasn't good enough to, you know, I took it probably as far as I could have taken it. But, you know, really for me, when acting came in and the way it was sort of introduced to me, I was playing college sports, but really once that happened, I was done. You know, I found something, you know, to play at this, I'm sure you know from your old man, it's like to play at an elite level, man, it takes, you got to fucking love it, and you've got to work your ass off, and you know, for me, once acting came, everything else just went sort of right out the window. That's what I wanted to do, and I knew it kind of immediately, and I'm super grateful to the person who kind of showed me that it was for me.
Yeah, know? but the great thing is that you have all this training, and you may not have been a world-class fighter on the professional circuit, but you know how to do it. So then when you have to do it and you have to do the stunts and you understand the physicality behind mm-hmm. it and you understand how to hold your back. I mean, I grew up a super nerdy kid, and it wasn't until my 30s that I said, oh, I think I'm going to start exploring fitness because I don't want to hit 50 or 60 sure. and then try to figure out how to turn this fucking rusty old ship around.
Sure, sure.
And what was so interesting about exploring the things that you learn boxing or in the gym or whatever are these weird kind of life lessons that you take into the world and principles that you take into the world. And I never would have, no one could ever explain that to me. I just had to experience it.
I think you're right, man. I mean, look, I think you can make arguments both ways because, I know plenty of guys, myself included, that high school football is one of the most dangerous fights. You know,
oh,
you
that.
Have
yeah,
120-pound
yeah.
kids on the field with, like, you know, it's like some guy who hasn't hit puberty versus some 250-pound monster who's, yeah. like, in the gym. And I think everybody I know who played, you know, real competitive high school football has injuries where, I mean, I still to this day, you know, the big injuries in my life are from high school football. That being said, I think the second part of what you were saying is absolutely true. There's no question that for me, you know, athletics, you know, it's a mindset, you know, and I think especially in the theater where I started, I really looked at acting and theater acting, especially as an athletic endeavor and you know, the way that you practice and discipline and honestly, the way you deal with competition and make it work for you rather than against you. And you know, I think, you know, before, still to this day, I mean, people, you know, Tom Holland will tell you, you know, before big scenes, you know, I'm slapping people, you know, I mean, I'm shaking people. I'm like, let's go, you know, and I think that that's part of it, something on the line, something to cost. And I'm really grateful for it. And I think, you know, with boxing especially, you know, you're really, it's just you up there and you got to go forward and you're terrified, you know, and I think that, you know, I often think that fear is just such an unbelievable motivator. And for me, you know, when I'm looking at projects and when I want to do something, I mean, you know, Frank Castle is sort of a perfect example. You know, that part sort of scared the shit out of me. Not just because so many people care about it and it's, you know, his relationship to the military and to law enforcement and just the comic book audience and how much they, you know, it's like, if you're going to do that, you better fucking do it right. You know, those guys, you know, comic book audience does not play. And I think, you know, for me, you know, being a father and being a husband and knowing that love and knowing what that's like, I knew that, you know, the only way to sort of understand what it would be like to lose all that is to know what it means to love it and to love people way more than yourself and to happily be willing to give your life for those people. That sort of seed of imagination, like trying to imagine what that would be like, was something that really scared me. I knew it would take me to,
right.
you know, super dark places, and that scared me. But if I feel that fear, I know that that's something I got to do.
Yeah, well, that's, so this might be sort of a hippy dippy question, but you just touched upon it, and I'm always interested to hear how people approach it. You know, obviously it's all pretend, but if you're accessing these emotions, like you say, going to dark places, how real is that fear that you mentioned of, what if I hit upon something that I don't really want to feel or face, or what if I relate to this too much? Is that kind of a scary thing as well?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's scary. I mean, but like, I think that your goal should be to sort of like run as hard as you can towards the fear, to run as hard as you can. I mean, I think that's true. You know, with any artist, like, run towards the shit that makes you feel and fear and pain and you know, joy. I think these are all things that you know, I mean, what we're trying, I don't know, I'm now the one getting fucking hippy dippy, but I think that's what we're trying to, I mean, fuck it, kumbaya, motherfucker.
Yeah.
I mean?
Come on.
I think what we're trying to do with art is to try to explore sort of nooks and crannies of the human condition that you can't put a name to. And you know, if there's this sort of fear that you've never really experienced before, this idea, this thought, this kernel of an idea that scares the living shit out of you, and you change your behavior in your real life to try to get to that point, so then you can access that in the 5 seconds between action and cut, I say run towards that as hard as you can. I mean, we operate under this umbrella of safety anyway. You know right. what I mean? I'm not really fighting bad guys in Hell's Kitchen. You know, when
wait, what?
Right?
No, I thought it was, but I saw you hit that guy. You think that's not real?
So, I mean, I think that if you can go down that, for me, if I can go down that path a little bit and run towards that through my imagination or through the certain situations I get myself in off camera, I think that, you know, I think that's just part of doing your job.
Right. But it's so interesting to hear the approach of, you know, the discipline and the, because even you showed up at 9:02 and you're like, I'm sorry, I'm late. Like, there's just like 2 minutes. This doesn't even count in Los Angeles.
Me, I can hear my father, you motherfucker.
No.
You stupid motherfucker. Where was your margins for error? Where were your margins for error? You know what I mean? That's just.
Your dad was a lawyer?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, a sort of like a self-hating lawyer. You know what
Got
I mean? He's you know, blue-collar guy, grew up in Syracuse, kind of went that way and sort of worked up the chain. And then sort of in a way, you know, he became sort of this big lawyer, and then he left, and now he runs he's the chairman of the board of the Humane Society of the United States. So
oh,
he just
wow.
works with animals, yeah, full time.
That's fantastic.
He's definitely the kind of guy who likes animals more than people, like 100%. Yeah.
Did you feel, I mean, when he was saying, like, what the fuck, what do you mean? Is he razzing you, or is he being literal? Was he that strict? Was he super strict?
It's not even strict. It's just that there's certain things, and I mean, look, I think, you know, my work ethic and discipline you know, being sort of like a man of your word, I get all that from my dad. You know, he took that super seriously, and he just, you know, I mean, it's fucked up that we're talking about on the day I was late, but like,
you
know,
really late,
brother, but like, you know, I think, you know, that was just, that was a really, really important thing to him. It's like, you are, you know, like, you only get one reputation, you only get one word, like, you know, be there for your friends, stand up in the face of injustice, and be fucking on time, man. Like, be on time. Like, it's weakness to not be on time. And that's, you know, and in this business especially, I think it's just like, it's fucking inexcusable, you know what I mean? I think that it's like never let the things that you can control, you know, set you back. Like, that's in your control. Like, you, that's the only you are in control of
God,
that.
That's so such a great point, because so many people, when they go, oh man, I just keep getting fucked over by life, and maybe that's true in some cases, but I think if someone really take a deep dive and go, now, did you show up to work on time, or
you
12
do?
Minutes late?
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. It's like, it's so fucking hard anyway. I mean, it's like, things are hard, like raising kids, like the work, like, it doesn't matter, this business, any business, like, life is tough, but like, take care of the shit that's 100% in your control. And like, you know, it's probably going to be a lot better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because I think people don't realize, well, even in this entertainment business, you will probably work forever if you just showed up on time. Now, being talented and being nice to people, like, those things are very good too. But the longer you work, the more people go, ah, that guy's kind of a pain in the ass. Even if on a conscious level they don't know exactly why, if you aren't a person of your word and follow with the agreements that you make with people, it does stick in the back of their heads. And when you show up on time and you're cool to people and you're prepared and you do it, like, that, you know, being talented is a nice bonus, but that alone, I think, will ensure that you'll continue to work forever.
I think so. I mean, I just think it's just, you know, being respectful to, anyway, I apologize, man. I know, but it's like, you know, anyway, you know,
what's really fascinating about it is that I feel like I've already learned something from you, which is, you know, listen, so I'm like, 4, 6, 7, 8 minutes late, whatever. It's sort of a, you know, I feel like it's kind of the Los Angeles loose schedule that we have. But even just seeing how adamant you are about being on time.
It's making my skin crawl. It
actually makes me go, shit, I think I've not been paying attention to that, and I really need to be more aware of this.
But look, at the same time, and I mean, you know, I don't want to belabor it, but at the same time, like, I think you also have to not judge. Like, you have to not, like, the other thing I don't do is, like, look at that motherfucker, he's late, which I find a lot of sort of, like, discipline. Because, look, man, if you were to look at my life overall, and if you were to look... If like my buddies and my brothers were in here, they'd be like, John's fucking disciplined. Like, John's a fucking mess. Like, he, that guy. But I think in these certain areas, you just, for me, and again, this is just what makes me work. It's like, I need it to be soda. Like, I need it to be run tight. Like no fucking around. But if somebody, I actually admire the person who can show up, sort of like roll in, like been out all night, been fucking partying, eating, you know, shitty food, show up and just be, oh yeah, we're doing this. All right, let's fucking do it. I'm like, wow, man, if I could only, but
that person can't do that forever though.
You know, look, man, maybe not. I just know that does not work for me.
Yeah, like, that, no, would that not, doesn't work
I
for
would,
me either.
It does not work for me.
Boy, you know, it's so funny that Walking Dead's going into season 8. So when I think back to when you were on the show, it's like, feels like it wasn't that long ago, but it was legitimately like 7 years ago.
Yeah, man.
And since that time, you got married and have proliferated the Bernthal line. You have like three kids
they
now.
They just keep popping out, man.
It's like every
Which
other
is crazy
because
I haven't been home. I've been making movies. Like, I literally think my wife gets pregnant on phone sex, dude. I mean, I'm like literally not there. You know what I mean? Literally not there. But yes, three kids. My first son, I got married 5 days after season one wrapped, and then my wife gave birth while we were shooting season two.
And holy shit.
It, yeah, and I remember I got a call. You know, it was such a, you know, one of the real, you know, other sort of like just great kind of, you know, priceless sort of takeaways from Walking Dead is, you know, I kind of came up with Sarah Wayne Callies and Andrew Lincoln, who have great marriages, great children, great relationships. And so I had this unbelievable model for me. And it was sort of right of the years where I just kind of stopped with the world of like fucking up and drinking and getting arrested and just being sort of like an overall asshole, which for some people, they sort of hit rock bottom once and they change. I just kept hitting that motherfucker over and over and over again. I just couldn't learn. And I finally sort of did right before Walking Dead. It was kind of the gift of all gifts in a million different ways. But then to have these models of marriage and parenthood and how to do that in this industry, you know, there's no words that I can explain how it, all of them, Norman, Melissa, Scott, Jeff, but you know, Sarah and Andy, they just really, and they're different, but they just do it right. And they lead with love and family first. And, you know, I got a call. We were in our trailer and it was during season two. So we shot everything out of that fucking farmhouse. It was sort of this like three mile sort of hike into the woods to
Everyone
get there.
Everyone was excited to get out that farmhouse.
Yeah, dude. Our thing was I would always get there early and walk the 3 miles. Sarah and I would sort of walk together through the woods to get there. And I remember we were sort of getting ready and I got a phone call from my wife and she said, my water broke. You know, what does that mean? And I'm like, I'm like, Andy, her water broke. What does that mean? And, you know what I mean? He's like, I don't know. Ask Sarah. I'm like, Sarah, her water broke. What does that mean? And fucking, you know, and Sarah's like, you got to go. And I was like, what we got to shoot? What do I do? And I remember Andy just said, listen, man, get in your car, go to the fucking airport. I got you. Like, we will shoot scenes with just me. Get out of here. Like, don't wait. Just go. You know, because from Sonoya, Georgia to Venice Beach, California, without a ticket, that's a mission.
That's
man.
A fun. That is that it's is a mission, trek. Man. Yeah, that is planes, trains, and automobiles.
Yeah, man. And you know, I blasted out of there. I called my brother. He got me a ticket on a plane. And I remember it was the last seat. It was the last seat. It was a middle seat in the very. I mean, dude, I would have gone under the plane if
sure.
You know, but it was the middle seat. And I get back there, and as I'm pushing up, I remember I'm walking down the aisle, and I remember thinking, man, now I got sort of 5 hours to sort of sit here and collect myself, get out of the fucking zombie apocalypse, and start really, like, dude, you're going to be a dad, man. This is happening. Like, I have this time now for myself. And when do you get that time?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, what a great gift. And as I was going, I see this guy, and he's, like, looking down at his DVD player, and he's looking up at me, looking at, and I'm sitting as this big, giant man, and he's like, Shane? Shane's that? not you? And I'm like, ah, oh, shit, man, here we go. And I mean, that motherfucker from literally from Atlanta all the way, I had to fly into John Wayne Airport, you know what I mean? The entire way. He's like, so he had season one and we were just doing behind the scenes. So that scene there, was that filmed in Atlanta? I'm like, yeah, dude, the whole thing was filmed in Atlanta. He's like, but that scene right there, was that Atlanta? I'm still like, yeah, Atlanta. Dude, still Atlanta.
Still Atlanta. That didn't change.
That's how I spent my time. But
did
yeah,
you make
man,
the birth? Did you make it in time?
I did. I did. I made the birth and yeah, and then my son kind of grew up. You know, he spent sort of the first sort of, you know, half year of his life in Georgia on that set. And yeah, it was a super, super special time.
You know? Oh, that's really incredible. Because do you think you went into fatherhood? Just because my wife and I are probably, we've been married a year, mm-hmm. probably about a year away from, you know, as she referred to it, pulling the goalie. In other words, pulling the birth control.
I get it.
You know, it takes some unattended shots on goal.
Fair enough.
To make a sports reference, my only sports reference.
Fair enough.
And so I'm sort of wondering going into it, like, how conscious are you of, all right, I want to try to take these things that I learned from my parents, but then not those things that I feel like I could do differently or better or just wanted to. I mean, how conscious was that? And then how much when you're actually doing it, is it like that just all goes out the window?
I mean, I think it's all the above, man. I mean, look, it's the biggest job. You know, not to intimidate, it's the biggest job you're ever going to have. It's the most important job we have, in my opinion. And I think, unfortunately and fortunately, it's one of those things that, like, you're just not going to do it perfectly. You're going to do the best that you can. And you're gonna put everything into it. But these are human beings. And,
right.
and you're going to fuck up. And I think sometimes the more I plan and the more I plan, watch me father this puppy. Like, hey, man, get down. Hey, all the way. Get. Good boy. Sorry about that.
Nicely done.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, just got to keep him nice and high on marijuana. Get sativa and you just like, he'll be fine. You know, I think that sometimes, like, the more you plan and the more you sort of make rules for yourself, the less you actually are opening your heart and opening your eyes to the individual child and seeing what they're going through. And look, my mom, you know, my mom raised three boys. She's a foster mom. They've had, you know, dozens and dozens of foster kids through their house, and I've seen kids come in, you know, with you know, unbelievably rough situations, and just showing them love and being open to them, how much they change and grow, and they all sort of come back to her, and they want her to be a part of their lives, and I think my mom is, you know, this would embarrass her, but you know, I think she's sort of like this perfect mom, and I think the thing that she would say more than any other is, you know, listen, open your heart and open your eyes to the actual kid. And I think, yeah, look, man, I struggle with it all the time. I want my two oldest are boys. I want them to learn what I've learned, but I do not want them to learn it the way that I've learned it. You know what I mean? And yeah, I think it's just one of those things that you got to keep on adapting, and there's no right way to do it, and you got to make peace with the fact that you're gonna fuck up. And my only advice would be. And is really acknowledge it when you do, like, daddy fucked up, and like, divorce yourself from this idea of being the perfect parent and admit your mistakes and admit your shortcomings and admit, hey, this guy could probably teach you this better than I could, you know, and being okay with that. And you know, but shit, man, it's everything. You know, you're never gonna just crush it. I mean, there are days where you're like, dude, I fathered the fuck out of them kids today. But you know, there's also days where you're like, damn, dude, like, this, you know, they got the better of me, and like, I didn't handle that well. I got frustrated, and again, I think it's about just being super, super honest. But I think just the fact that you're thinking about it, and you have a great woman, you know, I think like, you guys, you know, I think your heart's in the right place, and that's like half the battle.
It is. I think, you know, being a much older dad, because I'm older than you are by a few years, and I think that, I don't think I would have been a good dad young.
Sure.
Because I was also a fuck up.
Sure.
When you like, before you kind of straightened everything out, what do you think you were rebelling against? Were you hate yourself, or were you just hate the world, or didn't really think about it?
I don't know. You know, it's really, really a good question, man. I think that from a young age, I sort of, there's no question I dug attention. There's no question that I wanted to sort of shine. I both my brothers are like enormously successful. I'm the middle child. My little brother It's like fucking perfect, dude. You know what I mean? Like, went to Princeton, like, played sports, you know, perfect. You know, now he's a world renowned cancer surgeon. You know what I mean? Yeah, he's like just a little, he's like built hospitals in India and Africa. And he's like, you know what I mean? Oh, I mean, literally goes down the street, motherfuckers like drop roses in front of his feet, like coming to America. You know what I mean? But like, he's, and then my older brother is just this, you know, enormously successful businessman. And you know, he's like super good looking and all this shit. And like, they're just, I don't know, for me, I always had a real nose for, and as you can see, it's like completely smashed in. I just had a fucking nose for trouble I really remember at a young age that like, that was how I was sort of going to define myself. And,
sure.
And I think, you know, in the end it helped because I grew up in DC and, you know, DC in the 80s and 90s was in a very, very, you know, rough place. And there was all kind of walks of life there. And I, by no means, had sort of like a rough upbringing, but I made it rough. I always sought after. I always wanted to be in the most dangerous places with the most dangerous people. And I think that that's how that's the road that I went down. And I mean, from the youngest of it, you know, trouble. I mean, serious trouble, man. You know, like my mom, like at times, like literally hiding me from the police. You know what I mean?
Oh, and my
like,
God, that's incredible.
Yeah, and it was just like, and I just didn't learn my lessons. And I was given every break, you know, and I only sort of had myself to blame for it. But, you know, and look, a lot of the friendships and the people that I care about most in this world are all the guys that sort of went through that path with me, who strangely are all doing really, really well. And like, if you went back to DC and you talked to people who knew us when we were young, I mean, there was like, dude, these guys were like, it was just not going to work out for this. And especially me, like, it was not going to work out for me. But, you know, I think at the same time, you know, I found, you know, this one acting teacher, this woman, Alma Becker, she saw something in me that just totally changed the course of my life. And I found something that I was able to sort of tap into, all this energy and all this, you know, boisterousness and insanity and digging into these parts of myself that when I dug into them before would only land me in trouble. And all of a sudden I was getting approval from it. And I was getting respect from it and it was working for me. And I'm enormously indebted to her. And she was the woman that, you know, when I sort of got in trouble and I couldn't finish school, she was the one that told me to move to Moscow and study acting there. And that's what I did. She married my wife and I. It was sort of the best. She was really like a guardian angel.
How do you just move to Moscow and study acting?
You know, man, there was a program there. It's part of the Moscow Art Theater. You know, it's like Stanislavski's theater and Chekhov's theater. And I remember, you know, I wasn't able to finish school. I'd been in lots of trouble, you know, all kinds of, you know, pretty serious shit. And I went to her and I just said, you know, hey, look, I want to do this acting. I want to be an actor, you know, but to me, I didn't know any actors. I was so far from that world. And I said, you know, I didn't think it would be any different than being a plumber or being a lawyer. You know, what are the steps?
Right.
And she said, you know, it doesn't really work that way. But she said, if I were you, you know, if I were a young actor in America today, I would go audition and try to get into the Moscow Art Theater School and go study over there. And I think part of her knew she needed to get me away from sort of the people that I was hanging out with in America.
Smart.
But she really believed in this system of, you know, hyper discipline and a place where there was a real reverence for the arts and where, you know, in Russia, you know, an actor, it's a very masculine profession. It's not, you know, it's not sort of this like touchy-feely, like, hey, we can do no wrong there. It's like, if you get into that school, like, they're gonna break you the fuck down, and you'll do acrobatics and you'll do ballet, and if you're not good, you're out. You know, it's not, and they'll like tell you you're not good, and they think, you know, your teachers are not people who are sort of trying to kind of like make excuses for their own failings or validate their own sort of shortcomings. The teachers in Russia are like the best of the best of the best of actors get the honor to teach. And you know, and I think just being in Moscow, living there in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was the Wild West, man. I think this kid who thought he was this tough, street smart kid from DC got a rude fucking awakening of like what real, you know, just what real life, just expand the fuck out of my mind. And I'm super grateful for it. And there's no way I would be able to be working as an actor if I hadn't gone. It was the best thing I ever did.
And Russia theater performs you. That's what I heard. I mean, it's a great, I've always wanted to go, mm-hmm. but I never But I just didn't. I like, where do I just go to Moscow? And then what? And then where do you go?
I mean, I can definitely hook you up with that, man. If you're, if,
do you speak
if
Russian?
You're interested. So I didn't when I went, but then, you know, after being there, I also played baseball while I was there. I played pro baseball in Russian. You know, nobody spoke. I had a translator in my classes for acting. But yeah, you pick it up, and I got pretty good, man. After you know, a year there, like I got pretty good. You know, it's not really a place where people are super, like, even if they know it, they're not really super down to speak English. You know what I mean?
Hey, everyone, I'm from America.
Yeah. Can you help me? That's like,
cool,
you know,
dashboard cam.
Right? I mean, so, but yeah, the theater in Russia is just, you know, it's a totally different deal. It's bigger than movies. It's bigger than TV. The theaters are packed. The theater is not just for sort of rich white people with white hair, you know, it's for everyone, and everyone's dying to get there, and the best of the best actors are all in the theater, and they're packed every night. There's no fire code, so people are sitting in the aisles, and it's a real, you know, during, I don't want to give you a history lesson, but during communist times, you know, there was no public gatherings, right? And so to do theater, the Moscow Art Theater was sort of a state sanctioned theater, and they could put on plays. You know, there's no church, there's no meetings, you couldn't get groups of people together. So to do theater there, it was this huge honor, and it had to be state sanctioned. And then once the state sort of realized that some of the things that people were sort of trying to get across in the shows were anti-government or anti-communist, actors and directors and playwrights were being assassinated. Meyerhold was shot in his apartment. Actors were sent to Siberia, and people, my teachers, you know, my three teachers were doing an underground play called Cinzano that's still running. And they would go in the subway stations, in the tunnels, and people would go in and sneak to go watch this play that
Holy
they put
shit.
On. And if they had gotten caught, they would have been executed or sent to Siberia. And they did it anyway. And everyone took that risk because it was so important to them. And, you know, my teachers, when they went to, you know, two of them fought in Afghanistan, and one of them, as an acting exercise to get out of fighting in Afghanistan, pretended like he was insane and lived in an insane asylum for 4 years. And like, those are the guys that taught me. And so it just was vital, man. It was like there was so much at fucking stake, and to get it right. And that's really with me, you know, like that's really with me. Like I'm not going out there and just sort of like, hey, you know, this is, let's make this paycheck today, or let's do that. You know, I really want it. I crave that kind of, those kinds of stakes in the work. And there, the cool thing is what I found out here is that there are people that are like-minded, that take it this seriously. And that's, those are the people I want to be fucking with. You know what I mean?
What did you take away? What did you take away from Russian culture that you thought was really beautiful, that maybe most Americans, when they think of Russia and, mm-hmm. and whatever the Russian stereotype is that's in their head, you know, what did you take away from it that
well,
was beautiful?
I mean, a bunch of things. I mean, I think more than anything else, it's just this complete lack of pretension. You know, it is not odd. And granted, I have not been there. This was 10 years ago, right? Even more now. I'm old as fuck. But like, you know, there's no pretension, right? So if you're going to have a conversation with someone, it is not odd that you would strike a conversation with a stranger, and at the end of that conversation, one or both of you are in tears. You ask somebody how they're doing, they are going to tell you how they are doing and what is going on in their life. The arts, you know, my best friend over there was this guy named Dima. I lived in this really shitty part of town called Park Kotori, Gorky Park. And when I'd walk home every night from the theater, there was always this group of young guys, and they'd be out there drinking sort of like a 2-liter bottle of vodka, passing it back. And there's this band, the Bloodhound Gang, and they thought I looked like one of the guys in Blood. So every time I'd walk by, they knew I was American. They'd be like, Bloodhound Gang, you know, and like, give me the finger. And I was like, yeah, fuck you guys. Every night it was the same shit. Then one night I saw my friend Dima, and he was getting jumped by these three skinheads. And I don't know why, but there was three of them and one of him. So I got into it with him, and I helped him out. And then Dima and I became like super tight friends. And he was just basically this guy who like kind of lived on the street. But he knew every single member of the Moscow Art Theater. He knew what was playing at the Bolshoi. He knew who the artistic director was at the Mali Theater. You know, there's just this appreciation and this fascination with the arts and being a Russian artist, how much that meant. And I hadn't seen anything like that since America. He's an American. American ball player. That's an, you know, and I really, that really struck me, you know, on every street corner, there's a statue of a playwright or a poet or a painter or an actor. You know, you go on the subways, people are reading Bulgakov and Tolstoy. I was really taken with that. I was really taken with sort of all this stuff that I kind of looked at growing up as being like kind of weak or lame because I was a fucking idiot. I saw there and it was, you know, strength, and to be honest and to tell people how you're feeling and be open and to know yourself and to work hard and to have pride in your work, you know, it really reshaped the way that I looked at the arts. And And look, there was some really brutal shit I saw, like some really, really brutal shit and some really crazy shit that went down where, you know, at first I was like, wow, this place is fucked up. But I think it all kind of melds into the sort of the same thing of this just, you know, the culturally, it was just enormously honest and it changed who I am. And I owe being there. I owe so much to being there and to Alma, this woman who sent me.
Now, I don't want you to incriminate yourself or anything, but young John Bernthal, you know, middle kid trying to find his identity, very tough for middle kids to find what their identity is.
Woe is me.
But one good crime story, one good John Bernthal committing a crime story that's Jesus not Christ. Too dangerous, like not too, oh, fuck, not going to get you in trouble, but just one kind of like, look, I shouldn't have done all that stuff, but one time I got away with this.
I mean, man, it's so bad. There's so many. But I mean, look, I'll be totally honest. I mean, I think the big thing that sort of like plagued me through the beginning part of my life was just sort of issues with fighting and with violence and sort of trying to find myself in that world. And you know, when I was young, it was always sort of like I wanted to kind of roll with the baddest and toughest kids. And you know, we got involved in some street fighting just sort of became a thing with us. And you know, I feel like and it really carried through with me a lot longer than it should have. And it wasn't, I think, this sort of like this thing in me that I needed to express. You know, I didn't come from this like rough and tumble home where I needed to get it out. And so I think a big part of it, I just wanted to kind of be involved until later in life. I think I sort of wanted to know what it was like not to be the guy standing behind the guy with the guy. I wanted to know what it would be like to be the guy who's in the front, you know, and that landed me into some very, very serious trouble. And it was sort of this thing of exploration. And I think that, you know, at a time, and I know you want a specific story.
You don't have to
give you a Monday, but I think that like with my friends, my group of friends, you know, I know this sounds, but I think, you know, we all came up together. We all knew each other our whole lives. And I think that it was sort of our way. I mean, we love each other, man. And it was sort of our way, and this might sound fucked up, but of, you know, getting each other's back and being there. We were always outnumbered. There was always kids looking for us because we sort of went to this school that was, it's a long story, but I always looked at it. It was sort of our way of kind of like telling each other we loved each other by like getting into these situations and showing each other that we had each other's backs and you know, not starting it, but definitely being willing to finish it. You know, like those were the things. Now, as far as like, I remember as a young age, a shitty crime story. I don't know. But so I used to steal shit when I was little, you know, all the time. And I remember one time we were in Kent Mill Records in Washington, D.C. And, you know, we would go and we'd steal CDs. You know, we'd all wear these like big puffy starter coats because we were assholes and you know what I mean. And I remember we were all in there and I just would do, and it was just so shitty that we did it. And I remember I stole the CD, and I was going for the door, one of the Kent Mill employees ran behind the counter, and I guess he had pressed some button. And they installed this thing that locked you into the store so you couldn't get out. So he ran over to me and he said, you know, and he ran over to me with a Polaroid camera.
Of course, sure.
And, you know, and so then now I'm like covering my face as he's chasing me. I was a kid. I was like 11. You know, he's like chasing me around the store trying to take a picture of me. My friends, here are my, you know, rough and tumble friends. They're just laughing their asses off, you know. And I finally had to give him a picture. And then there was like a big picture of me on the window. It said like student from hell, like never allow
him. Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, so you're 11. You're stealing a CD. This probably makes it like 1987. What are you stealing? DeBarge.
Oh, man. I feel like it was probably Beastie Boys. Like, licensed to, you know, like it was probably.
Oh,
like,
yeah. That was right around when Fight for Your Right to Party came out.
Yeah. Like Paul Revere and yeah, all that stuff. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, man. I mean, you stole a good CD.
Fucking A, you know, man. Yeah, well, I didn't steal it. I had to give it
you
back.
Didn't, you didn't know? Get away
like,
with it.
Yeah, I'll trade you the CD for the picture.
That dude, one
you
know? Time you didn't get away with
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
But it's so interesting that. To hear you say, like, oh, I didn't want to be the guy behind the guy. I wanted to be the guy. And then all these years later, in a way, you're manifesting that with the characters you play, specifically Frank Castle. Mm-hmm. He's not the guy behind the guy. Mm-hmm. He is the guy. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of that even when you have this life where you feel like, oh, I don't know if I'm going in the right direction, but you still were kind of training in a way for this thing that would ultimately be such a significant part of your life years later.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all goes into it. Excuse me. And again, like, you know, this I think that, you know, again, it goes back to, you know, fatherhood, and it goes back to, you know, you take all these experiences and look now. You know, man, I have in my real life, I really have found peace. Like, I'm super happy.
I'm glad to hear that.
Thanks, man. Like, I love my wife. I love being a dad. I love where our life. I love where we live. You know, I'm just enormously. I'm just happy and content. And that was something I never really had. Again, I think with Frank, you know, it's really, you know, luckily. You know, I have this sort of well of shit that I went through that, again, was self-imposed that I can draw upon. And I've been in these sort of situations and seen some stuff that, you know, again, I really would not want my kids to see or go through. But I've gone through it and I can draw upon it. But I think, you know, the biggest thing for me with Frank, again, is going down this road of what it would be like to lose this shit, you know, lose what you care about most and really do that honestly, you know, and really try to carry that with you. And, you know, when I go and I play the part, you know, I separate from my family and it's something, again, I wish I didn't have to do. I wish that the circumstances were different, but you know, you'll see, man. You know, 3-4 months in a row away from your kids. You know what I mean? It's crazy what that will do, especially if every day you're running towards the darkness. You're running towards, you know, you're not at nightclubs or eating Chinese food or going to see movies. You're like walking by yourself, trying to sort of stay in it. And again, this is only because I don't know. I don't believe in myself enough that I could do it the other way, but it's the same thing that I did with Shane. It's really what I do for all these parts. And so again, I don't think that kid who's like down to fight anybody or, you know, living crazy and getting fucked up all the time. There's no way I was acting back then, but there's no way that guy could do what I'm doing now. Like, I think, to me, I want all of that to be channeled into the art. I want all of that to be channeled at work. And Andy Lincoln really put it to me best, man. I remember he told me, he said, man, I don't need anything. He's like, I don't need to party. He said, this is my disco. We were on set. He said, this is my fucking disco, man. I do it all here. And he said, everything else is just being with my family and finding peace and resting and enjoying. But like all the shit, I put it all into here. And it was such an enormous gift to me to sort of hear that and see that firsthand, you know, as a number one, as an actor, as a father, as a husband, right before I was embarking on the journey of my life, which was really to be a father and a husband, you know?
Was there anything as we're sort of winding this down, was there anything this season, Punisher, because obviously, you know, Frank Castle there's still a lot of other story going on in Daredevil.
Sure.
And Frank Castle is essentially a murder tornado. So was there anything in the sea of doing a standalone show with him where you're like, oh, this might be too much, or I think that might be too far, or should we dial this back a little bit?
Man, I think the opposite. I mean, for me, it was sort of if there was sort of a dialogue between me and the powers that be, you know, in that show, was sort of the opposite. I have no interest. I only want to honor the fans, the comic, military. You know, I only want to honor the people that care about Frank. And to me, the one thing, you know, I do Comic Cons. I'm out there. I feel like I feel like I have an understanding of what they want. And if it's anything, it's like, do not go for likable. Like, do not go for, you know, trying to make him accessible. I think it's all about being bold enough to say, to dare the audience, to be eager for the audience, to turn their back on him. Say, you know, he went too far this time. And then to empathize with him enough to let that come from a true place of pain and not let it just be pure, not just make him a sociopath, to let it be coming from a place, you know, hey, Bam, stop that. Speaking of sociopath, I mean, he's 4 months old. He's already like thinks he's a watchdog. Chill, dude, chill.
I think he's just a little concerned about the Punisher. And, I think he's going a little too far this time.
Yeah, you're right.
Castle's gone a little too far.
No, sorry.
That's okay. But my last question for you is, unless you had, there was more that you were wrapping up there.
No. I think that's it. I think that is the line of communication. I will never think that it's going too far. I push for quite the opposite, and I think that that's what makes him different. That's what makes him frank, and that's why people dig. And I do believe that there is a little bit of this guy in all of us. I do believe that. And I think this just happened to be they fucked with the wrong guy.
There's a good life lesson in there somewhere, even though it's a little twisted because of the way Frank expresses a lot of this stuff. But if you are not the most authentic you that you can be, then you are watered down and you're diluted. And that doesn't even have to be a character, but just as a person, it's like figure out who you are and just be the shit out of that person, whether or not people are gonna, you know, whether, you know, instead of worrying about, oh, is everyone gonna like me, or right. it's like just be who you are, you right. know, just be who you are.
Right.
But I my last question is about Sweet Virginia.
Oh, cool.
Which is coming out in November, right?
Yeah, man.
But I don't know that much about it. Uh-huh. I know it's like a thriller. Uh-huh. So what
I think you're gonna like it, man.
Okay.
I'm really, really proud of that film. It was like, you know, it was one of these kind of perfect situations with this great script, this unbelievable director, Jamie Dagg. And I don't know if you know Chris Abbott. Do you know
him?
No,
I don't know Chris.
So Chris was on Girls, and he sort of started out kind of as one sort of actor. And he is I think that his performance in this movie, I'll throw it up there with anything, literally anything. People were comparing it to Javier Bardem in No Country, but it's the, you know, he plays, I don't want to give too much away, but it's about this small town in Alaska, and this hitman comes to town, and the whole sort of purpose of the movie is sometimes violence is needed to sort of burst people out of the dormant lives that they're living, and,
sure.
and real good can come out of it. And it's all these people have sort of gone to this little town in Alaska basically to hide, and then this guy comes to town and just fucks shit up. But the end result is, you know, everybody sort of becomes who they're supposed to become after that. And, you know, what this guy does is he plays this part with no bravado, no bluster. He does it with just, he's scary as fuck by just being really, really tormented and weird and honest. And I can't say enough good about the performance. And for me, I got a chance. I normally play that part, you know, and I got to sort of do something in a way that I've never been able to do before, and a completely other kind of part. And it was originally, they wanted it to be, the part was written for a guy in his 60s, and I don't know how somehow they landed on me, but I'm super grateful that they did, and I'm super grateful that they let me sort of find what I thought they were looking for in a 60-year-old man and attribute it to me. So the character has Parkinson's. He has there's a bunch of sort of stuff to kind of take away from the sort of Punisher-esque quality that people have sort of associated me with. But I'm really proud of the movie, and I think you'll really dig it.
Man, I am so glad we were able to make this work.
Me too, man.
I fucking love you, John Bernthal.
Thanks, man. Love you,
and
back.
I love your dog, and I love that Katie was the dog whisperer.
Yeah, you did great, dude. You handled that situation.
Well, Katie volunteers with rescue pets.
Oh, nice.
And loves animal, loves pits.
Nice.
And so this was like the when she saw that you brought the dog, like, yeah, this made her fucking day that she got to
didn't
hang
even
out
say
with
hello
dog.
To me. She was
no,
who the
no,
fuck is
right
this
for
asshole?
The dog.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You said, I have to go to the bathroom. She goes, I'll hold your dog.
The dog. Yeah, right there. Right on.
But excited for Punisher.
Thanks,
and
man.
Anytime you want to come back on, you are welcome. And this was fucking great. I hope you had fun.
I appreciate it. Best to you and your wife, man.
Thank you, sir. Best to you and your three kids and your wife.
Thank you, bro.
All right. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Rock and roll.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.